I'd like to welcome now, joining us by telephone, Larry Merkuliev. He is the co-founder and former chairman of the Alaska Indigenous Council on Marine Mammals, the former chairman of the Nature Conservancy Alaska Chapter, former co-director of the Native American Fish and Wildlife Society Alaska Chapter, much more environmental work than I can talk about right here. But welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe, Larry.
Thank you, and good morning to all your listeners.
You were born and raised in Alaska, and as I understand it, you had a traditional Aleut upbringing. You've also seen the effects of climate change firsthand. What are some of the changes that are happening in Alaska?
Well, that's true. I was born and raised out in the Pribilof Islands, which is in the middle of the Bering Sea, and my generation was the last generation that had a fully traditional upbringing. And it's actually our people in the Bering Sea. We've been out there for about 10,000 years, you know, that's 6,000 years before the height of the pyramid cultures in Egypt. And we were the first ones to notice the changes that were ecosystem-wide in scope throughout the entire Bering Sea. And we've seen so many changes. I mean, we talk about Alaska being ground zero and the proverbial canary in the coal mine for the rest of the world in terms of what impacts can happen and visit all these different parts of the world. So for example, I mean, the changes that are occurring are profound. They're huge. They're large. For example, stellar sea lions have declined in population over the last 30 years by about 80%. Northern fur seals down by 60 to 70%. Sea otters down by 80%, harbor seals down by 70%, eider ducks down by 80%, walrus are having severe problems. Of course, we know that polar bear are. Crabs have virtually disappeared throughout the Bering Sea. And then, of course, I visited other parts of Alaska, and there are equally profound changes occurring there, which I can talk about.
It's really ironic the extent to which indigenous communities, which really have probably done the least to contribute to climate change, are the ones who are having the deepest effects from it.
Yeah, that's very true. I think worldwide, it's people who are the closest to the land and depend upon the land and the waters are going to get the brunt end of the climate change events that are occurring. Out in Alaska, you know, we consume about 420 pounds of wild foods per year per capita, and that's probably the most wild foods eaten by any group of people in the entire United States. And so these changes are having really deep, deep effects on our people.
When you say that you are from the last generation that really had a traditional upbringing, In the place from which you come, in the, you know, the Aleutian Islands in the Bering Sea, how does climate change affect the traditional way of life? In other words, is it that the food supply is just so compromised?
The food supplies are being compromised severely. I mean, even salmon are being affected. The elders in Alaska think that salmon may very well disappear in the next 10 to 15 years entirely from the entire state of Alaska because of the problems. And our people have such a dependency on it. We have a subsistence economy where a lot of our foods, our nutrition, our community well-being, our cultural systems are totally dependent upon the health and well-being of the ecosystem itself. So I'll give you a specific example of one of the dramatic effects it's had, in my opinion, out there back home on St. Paul Island. You know, we're called people of the sea lion. We consume more stellar sea lion than any other indigenous group in Alaska. And it's the basis for enculturation of our young men. So the young men would go out with the older hunters, and they would learn about relationship, about respect and reverence for the environment, about hunting, the proper hunting protocols, about the ethics and values of sharing in the community, et cetera, about what it means to be a man. And when the sea lions decline by 80%, our hunters are self-regulating. They don't go out if the numbers are down. And as a result, the connection between the younger men and the older men have been effectively severed. And one of the unfortunate and tragic results of that in my opinion, is that we had lost in one 10-year period 70% of our young men between the ages of 17 and 27 due to accidental deaths due to suicide, incarceration for felony crimes, it was just a profound, tragic loss that we experienced. And that's—
did you say 70%?
70.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah, it's a big loss to our community as a result of that. And I don't think there's going to be any indigenous group in Alaska that's going to be unaffected by this. It's having really, really heavy and tragic results. And another thing that's happening with intensified storms and the weather systems that are changing so dramatically, our hunters are not able to predict weather as accurately as they used to. In some cases, we've had, we've had quite a few deaths in Alaska due to melting ice and getting caught in inclement weather systems.
We're talking to Larry Merkuliev. He is going to be speaking tomorrow at Sunrise Springs, tomorrow, Wednesday, the 7th of May, right here outside of Santa Fe. Now, you have a long, long history of public service and advocacy for Native communities. Tell us about the movement for subsistence rights in Alaska.
Well, I think we continue to have struggles there, particularly with the rules and regulations that are promulgated up there, trying to control our subsistence rights. I led up an effort, for example, it was the largest subsistence rights march in Alaska about 5 years ago to stop the state of Alaska from protesting a lower court decision that effectively protected our subsistence rights along the rivers where we traditionally had used them. And fortunately, we were successful in that. There was another effort that I led for getting federal and national and international recognition of our people's right to take halibut for subsistence. Our people have been taking it for thousands of years, but the system didn't recognized either federally or statewide, and again, that was a four-year effort to take just 1% of the human take of halibut. 99% were taken by sports and commercial fishermen, and we received a lot of opposition from several groups dealing with that kind of thing. And then the rules and regulations are, we're probably the most regulated people in the United States, because we eat and take a lot of things out of the natural environment, where we have a symbiotic relationship and a relationship of reciprocity with the environment using our traditional ways, which have been so successful for thousands of years. And because of we take so much, it's not like an individual hunter going out for a moose, for example, in the sports hunting. They might go out once a year or something like that. Our people are out there every day, and taking not just moose, but we're taking all the other kinds of species there, and every one of them have got their own individual regulations. And so regulations also, I think, are changing the way that our cultures do things up there in Alaska. And that's, you know, compounded by the fact that all these species are declining.
Right, right. I mean, you've been so active in doing things like making this legislation happen and making it go through. How do you make legislative distinctions between subsistence and sport fishing, for example?
Well, that's pretty easy. There's a lot of different standards that we indigenous peoples totally understand. One, of course, is that we have a historical and cultural ties to a particular species, and two, it's a major supplement to our diet. It has cultural ramifications. It has ramifications for our language. It has ramifications for, it's a communal sharing system that we've got up in Alaska in every single group, every single village. Whereas sports fishermen, you know, they're going out for their families or for themselves.
Right, right. Now, you've worked for legislation to protect marine mammals, and you just talked about some of the horrible statistics of the very large declines in marine mammals in Alaska. Tell us about this work and how it's working or not working.
Well, one of the things that we're very concerned about is that what historically has happened is that when there's something adverse happening to a particular marine mammal, federal agencies and the general public and particular advocacy groups it'd be the indigenous peoples that are first targeted. And that certainly happened out in the Pribilof Islands where we eat northern fur seal for food during the summertime. And certain groups certainly opposed our efforts to take a seal for our food. And we can prove through archaeological evidence in the midden sites in Alaska and the Aleutian Chain that we've eaten seals for 10,000 years. But yet I've had to be in the halls of Congress arguing with staffers who are saying, well, why can't you eat beef and chicken and you don't have to take seals for food? It's I think due to a lot of ignorance and misunderstanding as well as arrogance even.
Are there laws that do protect effectively marine mammals at this point?
Yes, there are. The Marine Mammal Protection Act is the major act I think that applies to a lot of the marine mammals up in Alaska that's governed by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and the National Marine Fisheries Service. And we've worked hard in developing co-management agreements with these agencies so that we are, the indigenous peoples are the ones responsible for determining what we need to do, what we need to take in terms of our food requirements. And I want to point out that this whole word subsistence is a little bit misleading. I mean, in the part of the challenge we've got with these laws is that it simply relegates it to in economic terms or food need terms. Granted, that is probably the number one priority, but also they're such an integral part of our way of life and our cultures and our and working with our youth so that they begin to learn how to respect and revere not only the animals that we take, but also, you know, learn the ethics and values. We don't take any more than we need, ever. And we don't waste. And whatever we take must and should be shared with everyone in the community. And so these are really important aspects of subsistence that I think many people really don't understand.
Do you feel that Native communities are well represented when it comes to the conversations that are going on in Alaska, whether they be scientific or political, about climate change?
Well, it's beginning. You know, our people were the ones in the Bering Sea to flag the beginnings of these problems back in 1977. And up until, I would say 10 years ago, we were met with deaf ears. The agencies and the various boards and councils that deal with the scientists considered our information anecdotal, which would be like interesting pieces of information that may or may not be useful. And the Western system is not set up to affirm information that is gathered from an indigenous way of life and observations. But because what we have said has come true, scientists are now beginning to understand that indigenous peoples really do have an invaluable role to play in understanding the changes that are occurring, and we're seeing the changes at the subtlest of levels, and these subtle changes can have very profound effects, and our people see things in terms of connections and interactions between different parts of the environment and nature. And the scientific systems are set up to focus on particular aspects of the environment, and they don't necessarily look at all the connections, although they're now beginning to realize that they need to do that. So, yes, I think our voices are now starting to be heard.
People outside of Native American traditions, I think, are very hungry to gather some of the wisdom that Native traditions have built into their culture, as you've talked about, for example, taking just what you need and having a reverence for nature and having an understanding, a very deep understanding of how it works. I mean, you've talked about even things like being able to predict the weather and so on. It seems like you in particular are a real bridge builder between the scientific way of thinking and the Native way of thinking. How do you communicate?
That's really a good question. I was part of chairing a North American gathering of indigenous peoples down in Chiapas, Mexico in March of this year, where we had people from Canada, the United States, and Mexico gathered, and in proxy they represented perhaps over 1 million indigenous peoples in the Western Hemisphere, and we're talking about that exact thing. We're asking the elders and the wisdom keepers to share what they know and understand about how we got to where we are, how our people did, what this current situation is, where do they think it's going, and what do they think we need to do. And I was just down in Arcata, California, talking with the northern tribes in that area, and up in Seattle, in Washington State, talking with the Pacific Northwest tribes, doing the same thing. There are a lot of gatherings now that are occurring by indigenous peoples that are focused on these kinds of issues, and the elders say that there's an urgency to get the information out, to communicate with the general public, to share what we know, that the time is now. The situation, I heard elders say, you know, they're really worried, and I've never ever heard elders say that before about what is happening. And in Alaska, the elders say, you know, what's happening here is going to happen to the rest of the world, and we need to get the information out. We need to share what we know, and we need to help people to prepare and to adapt.
I think sometimes what's really hard for people is not so much knowing what the problem is, but knowing what their role is in making changes for the better.
Exactly.
How do you help people think about this? I mean, you know, whatever else happens, you need to get to work, you need to drive your car. The big decisions about getting a new car are few and far between. You know, how do you help people with this?
Well, you know, I like to say that, you know, it was Einstein, I think, that said that you can't solve the problem with the same consciousness that created the problem. And, you know, we can see that as an immediate example that I think a lot of listeners might be familiar with is the whole biofuels issue, where it became an initiative. Biofuels might become an answer to lowering carbon dioxide emissions into the air. And of course, now what we're finding out in retrospect is it's having effects that we didn't, that people didn't expect, and it's adverse to the environment. We're having the farmers in the United States that are shifting their food crops into biofuel crops. And that's starting to tighten the cost, contributing to the cost of foods. It's estimated that maybe the raise in the food cost now in the United States, maybe 15% or 20% is attributable to that particular action on the part of farmers. And then worldwide, we've got people who are in underdeveloped countries who are strip mining their trees in order to raise biofuel crops. And that, of course, when you take the trees out, they take the carbon dioxide out of the air, is contributing to global emissions. So that's the whole point of that is that, you know, we've got to really think outside the box. And this is where a marriage, I think, between traditional ways of knowing and Western science could really be a good thing to do, because we can see things that other people can't, and we look downstream. And many traditions literally look like seven generations down. What actions do we take today that would have a beneficial or adversarial effect on people seven generations from now? And so I urge people to really begin to think that, you know, the elders lament the fact that the initiatives that or people have talked about, you know, replacing your light bulbs, going to hybrid cars, really doesn't get to the root cause of how we got to where we are today, and is going to be inadequate to meet the changes that are occurring in terms of stemming the trend of global warming and global climate change.
We're talking to Larry Merkuliev, and he will be in Santa Fe tomorrow, May 7th at 5:30 at Sunrise Springs. And what are you going to be talking about tomorrow?
Well, I'm trying to put a human face to this whole issue of global climate change. And since in the United States, Alaska is the hardest hit right now, you know, I'm going to talk more about that and what our people are seeing, what their prognosis is if we don't do anything, and what they feel we need to do.
You just said a moment ago things like changing your light bulbs and so on don't get to the root problem of how we got here in the first place. How do you see the root problem?
Well, the elders, and we discussed this down in the convening in Chiapas and all these other places, and the root cause, according to our elders, and I think it's absolutely true, is that we have developed a consciousness of separation. We first separate from our feelings and our bodies and what our bodies are telling us, and to the point that, you know, if we're popping pills to try to take care of this problem and that problem. And when we separate from our bodies based on the elder wisdom, we separate, it becomes easier to separate from others, and therefore we start to have more and more conflicts. And so based on that observation, they feel that global conflict is probably going to increase. And we separate from the earth. And, you know, the elders say that we need to get our children out there in the environment, get them out of the cities, reestablish their relationship to nature so that they can learn to respect and revere it and learn from it. All of our indigenous traditions around the world look at nature as our college, or as our university. It's our school. It teaches us what we need to do, and it's based on that intimate relationship with the environment where we're able to pick up the cues as to what we need to do to adapt to the changes and be in harmony with what nature is doing.
So much of the nature that we are living in right now, in other words, the way we get our food and the way we get around and so on, is based on a corporate consolidated model where food comes from huge farms and so on. Do you see a breakup of that back to, for example, family farming as a real solution, as a necessary solution?
I think it's definitely going to be a necessity, and I think circumstances may push it to that point anyway, regardless of whether or not we make the choice, but hopefully we make the choice to do that. And we talk about, you know, bioregional economics. We need to, within regions, begin to figure out what it is we need to do within our region to be self-sufficient without importing things from throughout the world. One of the things that's happening is, you know, with this monogenetics, these singular types of genetic stocks that are used in industrialized agriculture today, is anathema. It doesn't have, these kinds of stocks don't have resiliency, so that, you know, at a time when the climate is changing so profoundly throughout the world and is going to accelerate and intensify, there's going to be new diseases that come in, for example. And if that stock, one gene, one genetic type of corn, for example, gets a blight, it could wipe out the entire industrial sector in that area. You know, indigenous peoples, we've always understood the need for this to have genetic variability. And I was down in, when I was down in Mexico, I visited a community that had over 200 different varieties of corn, for example, knowing that there might be circumstances that come in that wipe out particular stocks.
And it's not like we don't know this. I mean, that's what the potato famine in Ireland was about.
Exactly.
Larry Merkuliev, thank you so much for spending this time with us on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Thank you for having me.